Recording, you're okay.
Okay, we're up and running.
Well,
Excellent. I'll
great.
start. I'm going to share now. So let's make sure this works. Come on.
Yep, we've got it.
You got it. Okay.
Brilliant.
So it's just my usual opening thing. And you've all been before, so you know what I'm doing. I didn't go through that. But I'm going to pick up where we sort of ended last time. And I didn't go through it in much detail. So we're looking at these contradictions or possible contradictions. What do we make about the fact that sometimes it seems as though the Bible is contradicting in one of two different ways? It either could be contradicting itself, it's an internal contradiction, or it seems to contradict something that we know from elsewhere, either history or science or geography or something. That would be an external one, but we're really only looking at internal ones. I'm not going into all the big stuff at this stage of how does the Bible relate to other things that we know or people think they know. This is just what do we do when we find things that seem to not match up with what it's saying elsewhere. So some clues first of all before we look at the particular texts. The first thing is always to think about the type of literature that you're reading. What is the genre of the book? Because the gospel is different from a letter is different from a psalm, and all the rest of it. So sometimes the type of book that you're reading will help you to understand whether or not it's saying the same sort of thing or contradicting it. And on a similar sort of line, the language that's being used, is it an idiom? Is it something where you don't actually take it literally, it's standing for something else? So that can be an issue which helps resolve a so-called contradiction. For instance, I'll give you an example off the top of my head, but we know, for instance, that you are meant to honor your father and mother. That's one of the big commandments. And yet Jesus seems to be saying at some point that you've got to hate people like that. That's one of the things he says in the Gospels, that if you don't hate them, you can't follow me. But of course, in that context, you have to understand that hate is an idiom which doesn't mean, have nasty, horrible emotions towards them and so on. It just means to love is to put someone first and to hate is to put someone second. So it's not about emotions and feelings and things like that. You can still honor someone, your father and mother, but still put God first. So that would be an example of how idioms sometimes help us get around things that we think are contradictory. Others are just simply the fact that we don't know enough geography, history, culture, and things like that. So it's not the Bible that's at fault, it's us that's at fault. We are misunderstanding things. And with a bit more extra study and looking at things with a background, then we can put those right. But there are other times when we have to think, who's actually speaking at this point? Because sometimes what we're reading isn't necessarily what God has said, it's what someone else has said, and that person can be wrong. So just because a human being has said something and it's in the Bible, it doesn't necessarily mean that that human being has spoken something that's accurate. So we need to think who is actually speaking. And then sometimes there are scribal errors, there are translational errors. Sometimes a footnote helps us to understand that. But sometimes we just need to be aware that it may not be quite the perfect translation we'd like. And another thing that crops up is that the Bible as a whole is a book of progressive revelation. So what was revealed earlier on is just the first bit of the revelation, and later on, as the revelation progresses, you may get something which is not exactly contradicted, but at least seems to sort of move it on a bit. And so that might help you to understand why something might have changed or seems to have changed. So that's just some of the things to watch out for when you're looking at particular possible contradictions. And the first one I mentioned is this one about who bought Joseph. And so here's the text again for you to look up. There's some verses in Genesis 37. And then there's another verse in Genesis 39. We know that his brothers sold him. His brothers took his robe, put him in a pit. And then later in the chapter, he was sold. But who was he sold to? Because it says in verse 27, for instance, let's sell him to the Ishmaelites, because there were some Ishmaelites suddenly coming along. They looked up and saw a caravan of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead. So they said, let's sell him to the Ishmaelites. And then it says in verse 28, when the Midian merchants came by, they sold him. So who did they sell him to? And you go back to on to chapter 39 and verse 1, and you're back to the Ishmaelites again. So we seem to have got two particular groups of people. Which one was the right one? Has anybody got any ideas on that before I reveal a few things?
Were the Ishmaelites Midianites anyway?
Well, that's the to me is the best solution. Let's have a think about the words. Who do you think Ishmaelites actually are?
Descendants of Ishmael?
That makes sense, doesn't it? And yeah, and of course Ishmael was from Abraham. And the Midianites, they were descendants of? Have a guess. Well, Midian.
Okay.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
And actually, Midian then becomes a place. So you could argue that Midianites means that they came from a particular place. Midian was also a son of Abraham, but not through Sarah or Hagar, but through one of his concubines called Keturah. But the name Midianite probably then becomes attached to a larger group of people, particularly those that were associated with a particular area, because Midian was also an area. So you can have Ishmaelites who are Midianites. Or at least, if they're all descendants of Abraham, they probably were related in some way. So it's one of those things where we didn't think they were totally different people. Some people try and work it all out and say, perhaps there was two different groups came by, and they were going to sell them to the Ishmaelites, but they didn't. Then they sold them to the Midianites, and then actually the Midianites sold them on to the Ishmaelites. So it's the Ishmaelites that sold Joseph to Potiphar. So they try and work it out that way. But I think the simplest way is to say there's no reason why two people can't have the same, no reason why you can't have two different names for the same group of people. In the same sort of way as I'm both English and British. There's no contradiction there, whether I call myself English or British. One is sort of part of the other. So are they really different? Probably not. Is it just a different name? Quite possibly. And actually, I put here, does the following... does this work? Yes. Does that verse help? Let's have a look in Judges.
Didn't help me.
Judges 8. And what it says there, in verse 22, Israelites talking to Gideon, it says, you have saved us out of the hand of Midian.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you keep reading further on, it talks about the custom of the Ishmaelites to wear gold earrings. So the conversation goes on, I have one request, each of you give me an earring from your share of the plunder. So who did they actually plunder? Was it the Midianites or the Ishmaelites? Well, again, probably the same people, or maybe the Ishmaelites were part of the Midianites, and they were the ones that had the gold earrings. So again, there you've got the same issue, but probably resolved quite simply by saying just two different names for the same people. So that's a matter of something like geography, history, helping us to understand something. Here's another example, which is a little more bizarre in some ways, but then notice which book it's in. It's in Ecclesiastes, and that's why I said you've sometimes got to think what kind of book you're reading. Ecclesiastes is not gospel. It's not firm doctrine. Ecclesiastes is a book we'll probably look at in a lot of detail eventually, because it's one of the five that are read at different times of the year. Ecclesiastes is actually read at the Feast of Tabernacles, so we may well, if we get through to that stage, read it then. But what you've got in chapter 4 contrasts with what you've got in chapter 9. So in chapter 4, he's saying, I declare that the dead who had already died are happier than the living who are still alive. But better than both is he who has not yet been. So the dead are happier than the living. In Ecclesiastes chapter 9, verse 4, anyone who is among the living has hope. Even a live dog is better off than a dead lion. For at least the living know they'll die and the dead know nothing. So in one chapter, which is it better to be, dead or alive? Dead. In the next chapter, which is it better to be? Live. So is that a contradiction? No, it's just a philosopher musing about things, probably having a change of thought, probably just thinking it through differently one day to another. But sometimes you feel as though you're better off dead. At other days you think, well, it's better to be alive. So it's not a contradiction, because it's not something absolutely dogmatic. It's just an interesting discussion point, really, in each case. So can they both be true? Yes, they can, at different times, different people, different moods, whatever. And that's where you get this classic case in the Proverbs. In Proverbs 26, right next to each other, two verses. Verse 4 tells you to do something, or rather, verse 4 tells you not to do something, and verse 5 tells you to do it. So, verse 4, do not answer a fool according to his folly. Verse 5, answer a fool according to his folly. So, how do you know which to do? Any thoughts on that?
I've got a note here about that.
Yeah.
Man Bible. It says, verse 4 refers to subjects of no consequence, just foolish talk that should be ignored, while verse 5 refers to factual matters when it's necessary to be the correct speaker so he will know he was in error.
Interesting. Now, do you get that out of the text, or is that somebody's comment upon it that... Are they struggling with this and trying to give you a reason, or do you think that's really what the text is saying?
Good question.
Well, it's an interesting idea, and I quite like it, that, and I'll come back to that, because I'm not saying that's wrong, but that's someone reading something into the text. The text simply says, answer a fool or don't answer a fool. Okay, maybe the second half of each verse helps you. In other words, don't answer a fool, otherwise you'll be like him yourself. The other one is, you better answer him, otherwise he'll be wise in his own eye. Now, the real pointed issue here is, what actually is a proverb? Well, we've got lots of proverbs in English, and some of them are contradictory. Can you think of any two proverbs that contradict each other in English? Well, I'll give you one and see if you can find the other one. What about look before you leap?
Mm-hmm.
He who
hesitates is lost.
Exactly. Look before you leap, but he who hesitates is lost. So what should you do? Look, take time to look before you leap, or do you get on with it? So that's one of them. Too many cooks spoil the broth, but many
hands make light work.
Exactly. So what do you have? Or not. The point about any proverb is that it's not a fixed rule. Proverbs are general pieces of advice, and they're part of what's called wisdom. And the idea of wisdom is working out when it is applicable and when it isn't. So in some cases, putting more cooks into the kitchen is a good idea. At other times, it isn't. So in other words, you've got a proverb for both scenarios, which is great. And equally, when you're about to make a decision, should you think it over carefully or do you need to get on quick? It again depends upon the circumstances. So a proverb is just a piece of good advice and you've got to think when it applies.
Yeah. So
this is why I agree with the footnote. What it's trying to do is find two different scenarios, one where the first one applies and one where the second one applies. So we'd like to make that out again. So now we hear that in this context of what I'm saying.
Yeah. Verse 4 refers to subjects of no consequence, just foolish talk that should be ignored, while verse 5 refers to factual matters when it's necessary to correct the speaker so he will know he was in error.
Right. So one is just all sorts of banter and gossip and stuff that doesn't matter. And if you engage in that, you'll descend to his level. But if he's actually getting something wrong, then he would think, if you don't correct him, you'll think, oh, I know all this stuff, I've got it right. So actually, I like that. That's a good way of interpreting both of them within different contexts. That makes a lot of sense to me. Good.
Can I just say something here, Paul? I put a note in my Bible as well about verses 4 and 5. In Proverbs 26, and what I said was, these two seemingly contrary words are to be held in tension. God will indicate which one is appropriate in any given situation.
Exactly. And that is the nature of Proverbs, that they're snippets of wisdom, and at some point someone has found that that's true, and there's another time someone else might have found that the opposite is true, but the nature of wisdom is you have to, with God's help perhaps, work out which one applies in your particular situation. Good. So this is all to do with the genre of it. You know, don't weave a proverb like it's a gospel. People make the mistake of assuming that proverbs are promises. Proverbs are not promises. They're literally, the word proverb means a word for. Pro and verb, almost like a word for an occasion, a word in season. At another time, a different word might be useful. So it's not dogmatic stuff. Right, we looked at those two passages, or mentioned them, didn't really look at them last time. This is Jesus cleansing the temple. And this is where John's gospel seems to put it at a different time or occasion to Mark. You can see from the chapters that it's early in John, but it's quite late in Mark. Now, I'm going to come back to this later when I take you through things in Mark's gospel that will add to why this is the case. But given that they are very different, and Matthew and Luke would agree with Mark, of course, it's John that seems to have put it in a different place. So you've got a few options as to how you cope with that. One is you say, well, Jesus did it twice. He did it early on and he did it later. And that could well be the case. What you'd have to do is read both passages very carefully and try and decide if they are actually clearly the same event or if there's enough difference between them to be able to say, well, that probably occurred early on, and whatever it was, maybe 2.5 years later, it happened again. And you can find enough differences to justify that. But the other option is quite simply, the gospel writers decided to put it in a different place in their story. And that's okay, because they are not attempting to produce a biography or chronological account. They're trying to reveal truth about Jesus, and they're not really that bothered, except within the general scheme of things. Obviously, you know, he had to be born first and then grew up and then had his ministry, and then you get the crucifixion before the resurrection. So certain things are clearly in place, But when it comes to lots of these events or times when Jesus said things, the gospel writers, and it was quite okay to do all this then, didn't have to try and find a strict chronological order. And that's why you find Jesus' teaching scattered through the gospels in lots of different ways, different places. So it opens up a bigger issue here. So, as I say, you can make your choice on this. You can read them carefully and decide, well, they probably were two different events. Or you can say, well, John put it early for a reason. What is John's purpose in writing his gospel? Does he explain what we're meant to get out of his gospel? Has Mark written his gospel for a different purpose? In which case, he will have not only chosen these events, but he will have recorded them in a certain way. And as I'm going to show you later, he will have put events next to each other in order to highlight certain things. Anyone got any thoughts on that? Whether you particularly want to come down on the, well, it's two events, different times, or you think they're the same? Any thoughts on that?
The thought I had is that when we're telling somebody else about events that have happened, we don't necessarily tell them in the order that they happened. It might be something important about that particular incident that we want to get over at that point.
Yeah.
Possibly.
Yeah.
And I think if folk looked back at what I was saying, they think I was all over, probably.
Yeah. Well, quite possibly. What we expect when we're reading something is that the author has taken the trouble to put things in the right order. But that's what we expect now, and that is Greek thinking, that is linear thinking.
Yeah.
And one of the things I'm going to show you perhaps a little bit today and a lot more in the future is that the Hebrew writers do not write in that literal A, B, C, D order, obviously within certain limitations. So they just had a different way of thinking about things. If you can find some justification for John, let's suppose that it really happened towards the end, just Matthew, Mark and Luke put it there. Why would John have chosen to put it earlier? Why would he put it after the first miracle and before Jesus teaching Nicodemus? What would be the purpose of that? Now, I'm not going to try and explain that. I'm just opening up. This is how you might think about it. What do I get out of the fact that John has put this event at this stage and after this and before that? That's one way of looking at it. Any other thoughts on that before I move on?
I'm just wondering where the background noise is all coming from.
Yes, I'm wondering whether this is someone trying to say something, whether it's just... Is it Steve's
talking stuff?
Background. Okay, let's...
Oh, yeah, you mean Taurus, yes.
This next one, a bit more difficult to look up, but this is the occasion of Jesus healing some beggars. And again, we've got to try and decide, is this really the same event?
Okay, yes.
Or did this happen on more than one occasion? When you look them all up, you find that in one case... there's two beggars. That's in Matthew. And in Mark and Luke, they only mention one. And is that necessarily contradictory? The way that they've recorded it. There may have been two people healed, but someone only mentions one of them. And do they happen at the same time in the same place? What do you notice about anything there?
Well, one was on the way into wherever it was, and one was
Jericho, isn't it?
Jericho, that's right. Sorry, yeah. I was busy with pressing mute buttons.
Okay. Which one is that then? Do we know which one where it says he goes into Jericho?
I can't remember.
Well, I've got the Matthew one open, and that's Jesus and his disciples were leaving Jericho.
Right.
So it might well be in Mark and Luke, certainly.
Yeah, One is one way and one's the other.
Yeah. And in Matthew, when they were leaving, there's two blind men. And in the other occasions, when he's entering, there's only one. So, again, did this happen earlier and later? Because if you read the rest of it, it's all very similar, I think, isn't it? Yeah. They cry out the same sort of things. The crowd rebukes them. Jesus talks to them, and then he heals them. So it reads like the same event. Again, the gospel writers have decided to treat it slightly differently. And I don't think it matters to me too much whether there's one or two. It's like in the resurrection accounts, how many angels actually were outside the empty tomb. Well, if one gospel writer says one and another one says two, there probably were two, but one of them only has mentioned one of them. But you get these little sort of, what we might think of as being oddities, and we really don't like this, we don't want this to happen, because we want to be able to trust what the Bible says. But to me, that doesn't detract from the fact that this is still God's word. We don't have to spend ages trying to sort of justify and reconcile these things. It's just the way they were done. Any other thoughts on that one before we look at another one? You get the idea of what I'm saying then?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Actually, we don't always need to be. Sometimes we do need to resolve a contradiction. Other times we just have to, shall we say, live with it or read it as it is. Well, here's one we do need to sort out then, if you're ready to move on. Genesis 14:14. Now, you need to be pretty good to spot the problem in the first place, to be honest. But in Genesis 14:14, key bit is that when Abraham hears his relative, that's Lot, has been taken captive, he gets a little band of men, well, quite a large band of men together, really, and they set off in pursuit, and it says, as far as Dan.
Ah, yes.
And that's the problem, that in Abraham's day, there was no word called Dan. Dan is named after the tribe, you know, the place where the tribe was, and in those days it didn't make any sense to call it Dan. However, if you look at further ahead in Judges, and this is probably what I meant by later on we get extra information to help us, so we move into Judges. And then it talks about in verse 29. It tells you what it used to be called.
Laish.
Yes, so it was Laish. It was renamed Dan later because of Dan. And all that tells me is that when the book of Genesis was written, either it was when it was committed to final written form, or maybe someone went back and put it in, you know. Usually they would say Dan formerly Laish or something, but it's not a contradiction, it's just using a later name for the place.
Mm-hmm.
Which, in a sense, the Bible resolves itself by telling us later in Judges. So, again, you'd be pretty good to spot all that and to work it out, because you need to know all this information and be able to remember Judges as well. Now, here's a really important one in 2 Samuel and 1 Chronicles. And the question is going to be, who actually incited David?
Ah, yes.
This is David being incited to number the tribes, take a census of people, which was going to prove to be the wrong thing to do. But 2 Samuel 24 and 1 Chronicles 21 seem to suggest two quite different ways in which this was set up. So, 1 Chronicles. One Chronicles actually says, well, who incited David in 1 Chronicles?
Satan.
Who incited David in 1 Chronicles 21, does it say?
Satan. No, Satan's
God. Right, yeah. In 2 Samuel 24,
it's God, isn't it?
It is, and it says, the anger of the Lord burned against Israel, and he incited David and said, go and take this. Now, this is a pretty big one then, because we can't get around that very easily by the seam of it, because is it God or is it Satan? Well, there is a way to understand this, important. Mm-hmm. And that is, well, what does Satan mean? What's the word actually mean?
The adversary.
Yeah. And in a sense, Satan isn't really a name. It's a title or it's a description of someone. And your Bible will have decided whether to put it with a capital S or not. Now, in the Chronicles verse, it's the beginning of the sentence, so it's got a capital anyway. And so if we see it with a capital S, we tend to assume it means, you know, the devil himself. But the word Satan is used for anybody who opposes someone, who is an adversary of someone, who comes up against them in some particular way. So it's possible, and I'm offering this as my best solution to this, that what it's really saying in 21 Chronicles is that it wasn't necessarily Satan himself, but someone opposed or was an adversary. And God himself can do that. God can be an adversary. Okay, at this point, if the anger of the Lord had burnt against Israel at this point, he was in opposition to them. He was effectively their adversary. So I don't think it necessarily means that he had to send Satan along to do the work for him. Okay. So I would suggest that when we read Satan in 1 Chronicles 21, we don't have to think this is the devil as such. And in fact, that makes it interesting when Prince Jesus says to Peter, doesn't he, get thee behind me, Satan, as though suddenly he's addressing Satan. But actually, he may not be referring to the devil himself. He may at this point be using that name, that title, to refer to Peter, because Peter has just opposed what Jesus has said. So he said, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. And then Jesus says, well, yeah, I'm now going to have to go to the cross. And Peter says, no, you're not. That's not going to happen. At that point, he was Jesus' adversary. He was a little Satan in that sense. It doesn't necessarily mean that he was possessed by Satan at that point, or that Jesus was referring to him as Satan, but he was using a word that just meant adversary, or opponent, someone who is contrary to what's really meant to be. So the problem there is understanding the nature of the word Satan. When is it used actually as a descriptive title of the devil, and when is it just used to mean an adversary or an opponent that therefore could be human, or even in this case it seems to be used by God, of God himself. So that's what's coming up in this next thing here. Which is it? Oh, and I put another verse there to look up, apparently. In Numbers 22, let's see what it says there. Numbers 22, I've already said, whatever it's saying, it's about opposing. Oh, that's right. It says the angel of the Lord stood in the road to oppose him. Okay, this is Balaam. So at this point, if you like, the angel of the Lord stood in the road as a Satan to him. Translated like that. I'm not saying that's necessarily the word in the text. I'm just explaining that in this case, we've got the angel of the Lord acting as an adversary against Balaam. So those are just a few of probably the many times when you might think, I wonder if the Bible is actually consistent here or whether it's being contradictory. And just some of the ways in which we need to think through what kind of book is it reading? Have we understood the geography, history, the language used, and things like that? And usually, out of that, we can mostly resolve things that might otherwise bother us. Now, I'm going to come on to another little topic in a minute. Does anyone want to say anything on that so far?
Hi, just to say I'm listening. I just didn't want to distract people with movement, so I'm here. But it's
hello,
so
there.
Interesting.
Hello, hi. I've been able to join since I started. Great. I'm going to come back to this time thing, actually, because it's very important to realise. I've said that they don't always do things chronologically, and you need to understand that there's two different words used in the Bible for time. Well, two different Greek words, actually, so we're thinking New Testament. So chronos is a word that translates as time. But there's another word that's used, and that's kairos. Right? Anyone heard of these two different words, chronos and kairos?
Yes.
Okay. Chronos, well, there's a difference between them. Do you want to have a go at explaining how you would describe the difference between them? Or can you just remember there are two words without being quite sure what's going on?
Chronos is just time.
Well, chronos, time, is sometimes called clock time.
Mm-hmm.
I call it tick-tock time. It's where things happen precisely in sequence and there's a precise amount of time attached to something. So it's very definite, it's very precise. Okay, like, for instance, our meeting is from 7 o'clock to 8:30 on this particular date. That's a chronos event. Kairos is more qualitative rather than quantitative. I hate saying those words. Just about got it out. Kairos time is more in the moment. It's more a season. You're not watching the clock. You're not ticking dates off on a calendar. You just feel it's the right time for something. Okay? And life, for us, is made up of very precise moments of time, and also other times, hopefully, when you're not really aware of time passing, you're just enjoying something. Or maybe sometimes not enjoying it, but time is dragging or whatever, not just going the usual sort of way. So I'll give you some examples. These are not coming up on the screen, but have a look at Matthew 2:27. Matthew 2:27. Which you're going to come across fairly soon, perhaps frequently, part of the Christmas story.
Oh.
And Herod called the Magi secretly. This is Matthew 2:7. And what did he really want to know? He wanted to know, it says in my version anyway, the exact time the star had appeared. He wanted a chronos time. He wanted to be told exactly when something had happened. Because he needed to calculate something. He was going to have to work out how long ago this was and what he should do about it. Have a look in Galatians 4:4. By the way, there's very few occasions when the time is the chronos time. It's more often not chronos time. And here's an example in Galatians 4:4. You know this verse. I don't know whether you've got different translations to what I'm going to say. But in my version, well, it says something like, but when the time had fully come, God sent his son, born of a woman, born under the law, to redeem us, and so on. When the time had fully come, or at just the right time.
Yes.
Now, that is kairos time in the sense that, well, if you think about it, we don't even really know the date when Jesus was born. We don't even know the year he was born. People try and work it out and perhaps come up with some good ideas. But it's not something that is down there as an exact time. It's just at the right time Jesus was born. He came into the world exactly when God planned it. It was a kairos event rather than a chronos event. What about Ecclesiastes chapter 3? Do you know what that chapter is all about to start with?
Yes. There is a season to everything.
It is, and it might translate it as time, but if it says season, that's very good. There's a time for this, a time for that, a time to build, a time to pull down, a time to plant it, and a time to reap.
Yes.
But there's a time to do this, a time to do that. And it is the idea of there's a right season to do each of these different things. Now, some of them might be fairly regular and predictable, particularly if it's to do with harvesting and so on. But what are some of the other things that it mentions there? The right time to do what?
Weep and to laugh.
Yeah. Now, that's not fixed on your calendar. You know, tomorrow's my laughing day. But at 8 o'clock in the evening, I'm going to start crying, you know. These are times that come upon us. There is a right time to, Jesus might have said, to mourn with those who mourn, to laugh, rejoice with those who rejoice, and so on. Mm. So this is a kairos sort of time as well. Us Westerners instinctively think chronos, but quite often the biblical writers are thinking kairos. So we need to bear that in mind. And as I was saying about the way sometimes the stories are told, they're not necessarily trying to be that precise. When eventually you look at the Song of Songs, that is a completely jumbled up, non-chronological series of statements and events. Mm-hmm. So part of the problem for us is, where's the story in this? Where's the start? Where's the beginning? Where's the end? Where's the middle? And so on. They're not necessarily in the order in which we think. Let me test you with another one on this. Here's an easy question. Jesus was tempted how many times? It's not a trick. Jesus was tempted. Yes? Hello?
What did you say, John?
Three,
of course, that's right. So it's not a trick, don't worry. Oh, the next one's fairly easy as well. Can you tell me the three temptations of Jesus? I mean, just say yes if you like.
Yeah.
You can ask you what the three temptations are. Right. Now, can you tell me which order they come?
The bread first.
What second then?
Jump off. That's the temple.
Is everybody saying the same thing? Are you all in agreement on this? Or shall we look it up to see? Well, where do we find the temptations?
Luke chapter 3.
Okay. I think I heard you say, was that Luke chapter 3?
Yes.
Yeah. So early in Luke. No, it's actually 4.
Okay.
Close enough. And in Matthew chapter 4 as well. Those are the only two Gospels, okay? Now, if you can keep your finger in both and flick backwards and forwards, which was the first temptation?
Command this stone to become bread.
Right. Are you reading from Matthew or Luke?
I'm actually reading from Luke.
Okay, what about Matthew?
Let's have a look.
Is that the same?
Matthew says the same, I think.
Okay. So in Matthew, what's the second one?
To throw himself off from the pinnacle of the temple.
Right. And in Luke, what's the second one?
Ah. Yes, showing him the kingdoms of the world, if he worships.
Yeah, at a high place. And, therefore, back in Matthew, the third one is taking him to a very high mountain, showing the kingdoms of the world. But in Luke, the third one is the highest point of the temple.
Yeah.
So in one, we've got bread, temple, mountain, and in the other, we've got bread, mountain, temple.
Mm-hmm.
Contradiction. Can't both be right. And certainly this wasn't two different occasions. This was certainly one occasion. So what has happened is, well, in both cases, they're saying perhaps the chronology doesn't matter at all. Who knows? They might have happened in a totally different order to either of those. Mm. Or maybe they both got the first one right, but they weren't sure about the second and the third. But the point is this. They have chosen the order in order to fit their story, in order to fit their big story of Jesus, their whole portrait of Jesus and what they're trying to say, their theology, if you like. Now, in Matthew, it is an interesting way to you think about this. In Matthew, which is more important, mountains or temple? Now, for that, you need to think through the whole gospel and think, you know, which occurs where. But I'll tell you, in Matthew, there's more things happen on mountains than in Luke. So for Matthew, mountains are important. In Luke, the temple is more important than the mountain.
Yes.
Now, see, Matthew has Jesus teaching the Sermon on the Mount, on the mountain, or a nice hillside. Luke puts the same teaching, and it's Jesus is teaching in the plain. He's on a plain, not on a mountain. Is that a contradiction? No, it means that Jesus went all over the place in mountains and plains, and all they've done is they have chosen one location in order to summarize what Jesus was saying. So at some point, Jesus went up a mountain and taught all this, but this is not a one-off sermon. This is Jesus teaching several occasions, sometimes up a mountain. That's where Matthew puts him. Luke puts him down in the plain. It's not a contradiction. It's just a different way of summarizing it. But for Matthew, it seems that mountains are important. So he wants the mountain to be the third and final one, the climax. Luke builds builds the temptations up until you've reached the climax in the temple. Okay? So, again, chronology has been sacrificed in order to get across the main message. Now that might be the same as I said with the clearing of the temple, and hopefully we'll have time to put this back into the context there. So I want you to realize the difference between chronological stuff, which we tend to naturally want, and something quite different that the Bible writers tend to use. And just to say at this point that if you think about the beginning and the end of the Bible, beginning of the Bible, it talks about days in Genesis chapter 1. At the end of the Bible, it talks about the day of the Lord. And I want to put it to you that in neither of those cases is it meant to be thought chronos. Okay? So when people ask the question, how long are the days in Genesis chapter 1? My answer to them is always, I don't know, and I don't care. If God had wanted me to know, he'd have told me. Okay, this isn't chronos. But people seem to be absolutely desperate to work out whether the days in Genesis chapter 1 are this length, that length, are they 24 hours or whatever. And when Jesus comes back and it's the day of the Lord, he ain't just coming back for 24 hours.
No.
It refers to a season, a period of time. It's a kairos event. Even though there will be a moment when it starts, but it's certainly not on the calendar. We don't know the day or the hour. It's more kairos than chronos. So be careful about trying to make things too chronological when that's not always happens. Right, so I hope that's a useful little tip. I'm sorting a few things out. And I'm going to move on to the next thing. Unless there's anybody wanting to say something.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, last time I suggested that you might like to think about the structure of Matthew.
Yeah.
We did it with Genesis. We found these literary markers that helped. And we did it with Acts. And I wonder if we can do the same sort of thing with Matthew to help us understand how his gospel is put together. Anyone got any idea on this?
I had a look at these, Paul, and I thought that the marker phrase was in those days or at that time.
Right. How many times did that occur?
Well, I found five very definite ones.
Right. Okay. That's interesting. Do you want to tell us what they are?
Well, the first section was chapters 1 and 2, where you've got the genealogy. And then in the second section, we start with...
Chapter 3.
Well, chapter 3 says in those days on the back. Yeah, okay. I'll give you that one. That does seem to suggest that there's something happening there, yeah? Okay. Yeah. Anything else? Any others?
Sorry, let somebody else speak.
I mean, any others of that kind? Any other in those days that are clearly...
Yes, there are.
Tell us where they are.
The third section, chapter 12, verse 1, at that time, Jesus went through the grain fields.
Okay. But what about the fact that in chapter 11, verse 25, you've also got an at that time?
Okay.
And they seem to be a bit close together, or perhaps there's a lot more of them than we find, you know, that... And what about other similar things like that same day? Does that... You get these little sort of hints of time going on.
Yeah, but it's about a season, though, isn't it? You know, well, that time is really about a season rather than a specific day.
Good point, because we are back, let's say, to Kairos rather than... You know, Jesus didn't suddenly look at his calendar and decide, oh, it's time to move on. He was waiting to hear what Father said. And when Father told him to do this, do that, and so on, then it was the right time for him to do that. And that included the time when he was to go to Jerusalem to die. So, yeah, okay. I'm not against what you're saying, but I'm going to come up with something else in a minute. Mm-hmm. I mean, what I'm saying is that might well help you to read the gospel in a certain way.
Right, okay.
That's fine. You're thinking about how to do it. And if they come up, should we say, not too often, but also not too few, then you've probably found a good way of getting into Matthew's structure. Better than the chapter and verse numbers, I'll grant you that. Anybody got any other ideas or thoughts on that? Well, here's something to look for. When does it say when Jesus had finished saying these things? Mm-hmm. Any idea where you might find the first time that that happens?
Let's have a look.
When Jesus had finished saying these things.
Well, there's one right at the end of chapter 7.
That's the first
verse 28.
That's the first one, yes. So it is chapter 7, verse 28, first one. And, of course, it's the end of what we call the Sermon on the Mount. But remember what I just said? This is Matthew compiling the early teaching of Jesus into a single section. It's simply Jesus did not give this as a one-off sermon. For a start, it's too important, but also he talked lots of other things. So it's Matthew's summary, and then when Jesus had finished saying these things, and then we'll sort out of that. But it occurs more than once, so how quickly can you find the same sort of thing, or very similar? Again, can you find any more?
Chapter 11, verse 1.
Very good. That is, in fact, the next one.
When Jesus had finished instructing his 12 disciples, he went on from there to teach and preach.
Yeah. That is clearly a summary statement with a sort of division attached to it. Something has just finished, something else is about to start. Yeah, good. Keep turning then, see if you can find some more. Yeah, this is where your chapter and verses don't help you, because it could be in the middle of a chapter, it could be at the end, it could be, you would hope it might be at the beginning, but
kind of there's something that's a little bit like that in chapter 13 verse 53.
That's the next one. Yeah.
Now it came to pass when Jesus had finished these parables that he departed from there.
Yeah, but the parables being teaching, it's the same thing. He's finished teaching, he'd finished instructing. And if you know the chapter well, you know it's full of parables. Okay, so we found the next one. Good, well done. There's two more. That again, please.
15:39.
Well, this is after he'd sent the crowd away, so it's not the same as when he finished teaching something.
No,
it's not. Keep going. I give you a clue. They are actually, the other two are both at the beginning of a chapter.
Mm-hmm. Ah, yes, here we are, 19:1.
Yeah.
Now it came to pass when Jesus had finished these sayings that he departed from Galilee and came to the region of Judea beyond the Jordan.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Clearly, again, another marker by Matthew that we're moving on. I'll explain why in a minute, but can we find the last one?
Yes, 26:1.
Yeah, we got them. And Jesus had finished saying all these things. Well, he didn't go somewhere this time. He actually said something else, but we come to the end of a section. Now, those are the five, there are the little sort of devices within the gospel, but those are the five clear markers of how Matthew wants us to understand and read his gospel. What I'll do is I'll come back to this slide in a minute and go on to this one. The gospel has a symmetry about. Oh, just wait a minute. No. I've got them in the right order after all. There are five teaching sections, and he wants us to understand the teaching ministry of Jesus, which obviously happened over a long period of time. It's scattered all over the place. He has compiled it so that we can read it in five teaching sections. And the question that people ask, does this sort of reflect something like the five books of Moses? Is this Jesus, the new Moses, giving a new Torah? Well, I think that's pushing it a little bit, but if that's got anything to do with it, it's simply the fact that Matthew chose the number five. But the theme behind the whole of Matthew's gospel is making disciples. He's going to head up towards the Great Commission, go and make more disciples. So what he decides to do is write the gospel in such a way that we read at the beginning Jesus calling disciples, and then we read how Jesus made disciples. And this is how Jesus did it. He did it in five sections, if you like. In other words, looking back, Matthew can say, this is how I was discipled by Jesus. Firstly, I learned all this. Then this happened. Then this. And then this. And he has constructed his book in such a way that we who weren't privileged to be there at the time can actually sort of follow through in the same sort of way. And that's much better than dotting around backwards and forwards, okay? And it's part of the symmetry of the whole gospel. Let's look at this now. The first four chapters, don't sort of necessarily look this up yourself, but now anyway, but you know what's in the first four chapters. You get the genealogy, you get the birth, the baptism, the temptation, the call of the disciples, and the beginning of his ministry. That's obviously the way to start the whole story. The end, of course, is his death and his resurrection, his rebirth. So already you've got a symmetry happening here from his birth and death and rebirth. I'll come back to this idea of symmetry in a moment. But then the rest of the gospel is split up as follows. And you might want to make a note of these. These are the five teaching sections, roughly according to, you know, the chapters. So you've got chapters 5, 6, and 7, which we call the Sermon on the Mount. And then we know that's finished because after Jesus had finished saying these things, we move on to, chapters 8 and 9. This is about ministry and miracles. And then after looking at ministry and miracles, and it doesn't mean that Jesus didn't do any teaching at this time. It just means the emphasis has changed in the book. Chapter 10 is now Jesus calls his 12 disciples to him. He gives them authority to do various things and he sends them out with the following instructions. So chapter 10 is another teaching section. This is for the disciples now to go out and do stuff. What sort of stuff? Well, the stuff that we've just been reading about in chapters 8 and 9. So you get a batch of teaching, basic kingdom teaching. Then you see Jesus at work in his ministry. Then you see him instructing his disciples to go and do the same. And then you get another two chapters of what we might just generally call ministry and miracles. It's just a way of summarizing a non-teaching section. And then at the heart of it, you get chapter 13, the next teaching section, which is entirely in parables. Now, I haven't got time today to explain why Jesus' technique, his strategy changes to parables, but there is a reason, and I'll take that for another time. Because what I'm really getting you to the point of doing is to ask you then to read Matthew's Gospel, knowing now the format and the structure. We can discuss the theology of it another time if you like. So you get another teaching section right in the middle, and then you come out of that and you get another series of ministry and miracles. You go back into another teaching section, which again is just to the disciples. Okay. What's interesting is to notice whenever Jesus is teaching the crowds or the disciples, sometimes it's the crowds with the disciples there, sometimes the crowds aren't there. He's only teaching the disciples. So the parables were for the crowds.
That's
the next teaching section is for the disciples. Why? Because he's privately training them. And then there's some more ministry and miracles. And then comes chapters 23 to 25. And again, see the symmetry? That there's three chapters at the beginning, there's three at the end. And again, this is, firstly, he's teaching the crowds and the disciples. And then in the last two chapters, he's only teaching the disciples. And in these last two chapters, you get all the end time stuff. And in other words, Jesus did not start by teaching some complicated end time theology. He started with blessed are those who, and so on and so on. Only after all this time does he privately teach this eschatology to his disciples, not to the crowds. So it wasn't going around from the beginning, the end is near, and so on. He was teaching them about the kingdom, which was at hand. But later on, he teaches his disciples those. And that's framed between the first four chapters and the last three, which is to do with creating disciples. Okay?
Yeah.
So with that in mind, you've now got a structure, I hope, for reading through Matthew's Gospel. You could, for instance, read the first four chapters, then 5, 6, 7, then 8, 9, and so on to the end, with the main clue being, what does this have to tell us about discipleship? Okay, now I'm going to pause for a moment, see if you've got any questions or comments. Is that clear anyway? You know what I've been saying?
Yes, it is.
Could I just check something?
Yeah.
I'm not sure what the fourth section 18 was, sorry.
I'm not hearing that very clearly. It's a bit distorted.
I'm not sure what number 18 was, so that's the fourth section.
Yes, it's more instructions to disciples.
Okay.
If you just turn to it briefly. It's actually, it's instructions about what they are going to be able to have to do and sort out. It says, at that time, the disciples came to Jesus and they asked him certain questions and he told them things. But it's all teaching to the disciples.
Okay.
Now, again, we don't have to think of it, that was all happened on one afternoon and that was done. Again, Matthew might have been compiling something that took place on several occasions, but I think he's giving us in the structure that this sort of teaching didn't come till later on, when the disciples had already understood the basics of the kingdom, when they've been sent out and started to do miracles themselves. Jesus is slowly training them, because discipleship is about apprenticeship. Okay, it's about apprenticeship. And they are learning on the job, bit by bit, stage by stage. So they start to ask him questions in chapter 18, which fits where they're at that particular time, and Jesus moves them on another stage.
Yeah.
Any other questions? Because in a minute, I'm going to skip out quite a bit of what I've prepared because we won't have time. I'm going to do two other things in our remaining 20 minutes, but it all fits in with what we've been saying so far. So we've got a bit of time because I'm about to snip out a few things. Any other questions on Matthew's Gospel and how to take it apart and put it together again, if you like? Okay, shall I go on?
Yes, please.
Right. Now, what I was going to do is talk a lot about poetry, because a lot of your Bible is poetry. Do you know how much? Have a guess how much of the Bible is poetry.
50%?
Not quite as much as that, actually, no. But it's more like a third.
50. Yeah.
Because poetry actually isn't just about poems, and that it's most of the prophets are in poetry and so on. But poetry is a fascinating topic in its own right. I'm going to leave that, except to talk about one aspect of it, which comes in here. I've mentioned that Matthew's Gospel looks as though it's fairly symmetrical. And there's one device that they use. I'm just wondering how to do this. You just have to bear in mind while I skip through all the stuff I would do another time. Come back next year for more. There's a device called, got a funny Greek name, called chiasm or chiasmus. And that's because it's based upon the Greek letter chi. And the Greek letter chi looks like that. And so once you've seen it, all you've got to do is think, oh, it's like an X. And that'll do. And what the letter X represents is a sort of crossover or reversal. There's two lines cross over. And that often is the way that something is structured. And one of the ways in which we talk about this is we then use letters to explain what it looks like. So if I said to you, and that's not a pop group, by the way, that is ABBA, it means that the structure of what I'm telling you is something different, and then I reverse the process going backwards. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
A, B, B, A. It can be longer. You can have three things going up and down again. You can have something different in the middle and then you come down. that you go back down in the opposite order to which you came up. And that's how a sort of symmetry works in this sort of thing. Have a look at Matthew chapter 20 and verse 16. I'm just going to give you one or two examples from Matthew's Gospel. Matthew chapter 20 and verse 16.
Ah, yes.
Okay. Yes. What does Jesus say?
So the last will be first, and the first last, for many are called, but few chosen. Yeah.
Okay. So I must admit, I can't remember if it's, is it that order? Is it last, first, last, or is it?
Yes.
Oh, okay. But I'm not going to show you this one. It's not on the screen. I've written it down as first, last, first. But you get the pattern that the first should be last and the last should be first, or the other way around. The last should be first, the first should be last. A, B, B, A. We've gone in one direction and back again. It's a very typical way of talking, very typical way of writing, because it's a very good memory aid. And in fact, speech writers use this all the time. No, they don't use it all the time, they don't do anything all the time, but they use it a lot because it helps construct something that we pick up easily and you remember it more. So I think of Kennedy's speech, ask not what your country can do for you, but ask what you can do for your country. See what he's done cleverly? You know, country, you, country. So it forms a nice little expression. Have a look in Matthew chapter 7 and verse 6. Matthew chapter 7 and verse 6. Now, you may not spot this one unless you've been told this. So I'd like to read out chapter 7 and verse 6.
Do not give the sacred things to the dogs, and do not cast your pearls before swine, lest they will trample them with their feet. Then they will turn their feet. Then when they turn, they will tear you to pieces.
Right. Now, can you see the ABBA crossover form? Go through it carefully again. What's the first thing that's mentioned?
Sacred things.
And what's the animal?
Dogs.
Dogs. So we've got something to do with dogs. Then we've got something to do with?
Swine.
Pigs. Okay. Then what actually happens next? Unless they do what?
Trample under their feet.
Right. Now, who trample you? Pigs or dogs?
Pigs.
Pigs. And who tear you to pieces?
Dogs.
Right.
Oh, yes.
So it's gone dogs, pigs, dogs. Okay? I mean, it makes sense. Say like that. But so the first they doesn't go back to the dogs, so to speak. They go back to the pigs. And if we were doing it logically and so on, we would go dogs, pigs. That's the way we think. Dogs do this, pigs do this, blah, blah. No, it goes dogs, pigs, dogs. Okay? If you look at this sort of thing, it's very common. Still in Matthew's Gospel, the very first verse mentions three people. Three people mentioned in the first verse of Matthew's Gospel.
Christ, Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham.
Jesus, David, Abraham. Now you get to the end of the genealogy in verse 17.
Yes.
And what do you notice?
Abraham, David, and Christ.
The same three people in the opposite order, yeah?
Yeah.
A, B, C, C, B, A. Okay? I call it the Grand Old Duke of York thing, because he marched them up to the top of the hill and he marched them down again. So we've gone up and down. Okay? And that's a structural way of doing things. Now, think back to our five teaching sections. So the first one was Matthew 5, 6, and 7. And how does chapter 5 begin? Beginning of the Sermon on the Mount. Lots of time Jesus says, Matthew chapter 5, the opening verses are all to do with
blessing.
Yeah, blessed is this person, blessed is that person, and so on. You go to the one at the end, 23, 24, 25, And it's spaced out a bit more, but chapter 23 is full of Jesus saying, not blessed are you Pharisees, teachers of the law, and so on, but the very opposite, which is...
It's woe.
Woe. Okay? So, again, there's a match-up in the sense of the first section, the last section. Blessed are you if you do all this, but at the end he's saying, woe to those of you who are not doing this sort of thing. I'll give you another one in Matthew. Go back to chapter 1. And chapter 1, verse 23, again, Christmas time, you'll come across this. The virgin will be with child and will give birth to a son, and they will call him
Emmanuel.
And then you're told what that means, just in case our Hebrew isn't up to it. But Emmanuel means God with us. Can you see the God bit at the end of Emmanuel?
Yes.
God. Emmanu, it just means with us. So it's literally with us, God. Now, for some reason, Matthew has decided to quote something from the Old Testament. I think it's Micah, isn't it? No, it's Isaiah. No, get it right, it's Isaiah. Okay. And he's put in this little fact that they will call him Emmanuel. And then she gives birth to a son and she calls him Jesus. He's not called Emmanuel at all, is he? Go to the very end of the Gospel, chapter 28 and verse 20. And one of the very last things that Jesus says, when he said, go and make disciples of all nations, baptize them, teach them, etc., etc., he adds a very reassuring final comment. And surely...
I am with you.
Yes, and surely Emmanuel... Okay. In other words, the reason that Matthew has put Emmanuel at the beginning of his gospel is because it's coming up at the end and it acts as part of the symmetry of it, the chiasmus of it. And he was never called Emmanuel, but by the time you get to the end of the gospel, by the time you've spent 3 years with Jesus, by the time you've listened to everything he's said and seen what he's done, you should be convinced he really is Emmanuel. And he says then, and I'm with you always. So you see how sometimes the messages within the gospel, they might seem a little hidden to us, but they're there within the structure of it. And just one final comment on this, because if you're going to read Matthew, and we're having a break after this one, we're not starting up again until second week of January. So you've got time to read the whole gospel if you want. If he structured it like this, where's the most important part of the gospel? I know it's the death and resurrection in some ways, but if you structure it symmetrically, where's the most important bit?
In the middle.
Right in the middle. Mm-hmm. So the central two chapters, well, which was the central teaching chapter? Chapter
13.
And the one before it acts as the sort of partner with it. Chapters 12 and 13 are the pivotal central point of the whole of his gospel message. And I'm not going to tell any more on that because I want you to read it and find it. And I've got 10 minutes to do something slightly different, but not too different. But any comments on what I've said about that this structure will come up time and time and time again. And you get it in little snippets, like one verse. You get it in longer passages. You sometimes find that a whole passage is constructed like this. And sometimes you find it across whole books. Okay, and I've got more to show you another time, but I want to finish with Mark's sandwiches. And this comes back to Mark putting the cleansing of the temple where he did. Let's see if I've got these in the right order. So what I mean by Mark's sandwiches, forget the poetic bit about inclusio, we'll leave that. You've got to turn to Matthew 5. I'm going to do the first one with you and then show you four more. So Matthew 5, 21 to 43. It's sometimes called Mark's frames. He seems to want to frame something. So if you found Mark 5, 21 to 43, there's sort of two elements to the story. There's two different things happening. And it's the way Mark puts them together that makes a difference. So what do we start off with? We have got Jairus coming to Jesus and saying his daughter's sick. Yes?
Mm-hmm.
And that story starts. And then the next thing that happens is a woman who is bleeding comes to him. And something happens there. And then, eventually, we sort of have to remember that he's actually trying to deal with Jairus and his daughter. So, while he's still speaking, some men come from the house of Jairus and so on. So, it splits into those three sections, which is basically the Jairus story, the woman with the issue of blood, and then back to the Jairus story. Now, I'm quite happy with the fact that this is the way it definitely happened in real life. In other words, there's nothing sort of constructed about this. But it is interesting that when we read it, we read one story in the midst of another. One story is framed by something else. And what I would suggest is that if you want to go away and read these as a section, try and get into, if like, Mark's mindset on this. In, what's he trying to show us by putting these two events, not only next to each other, but sandwiched, if you like? Okay? And you might find in another gospel, you might find these two same events, and they're not set out like this. They're put just one after the other, or even several bits apart. That's part of what I'm saying about the chronology of it. Okay? So, if you made a note of those verses, I'm going to give you some more in a minute, just to glance at, and then if you want to read them and try and make something of them, you've got them written down. So, any comments on this one before I move on to the next? You see what I mean now by his sandwiches or his framing?
Yes, yes.
Paul, perhaps it would be good if you read out those actual verses. I'm taking pictures of them on my phone, but anybody listening to the recording...
Thank you very much. Thank you for reminding me. It's always going to be difficult for people who don't see this. Yes, I will. Thank you. So from Mark 5, 21 to 43, you've got verses 21 to 24, Jairus, start of the story. 25 to 34, the healing of the woman with the issue of blood. And then from 35 to 43, you get the back to the Jairus story and the completion of that. Thank you. Okay, this is Mark 11, 21. No, it isn't. Mark 11, 12 to 21. Mark 11, 12 to 21. Now, what I would like you to try and do before I tell you is what you think the sandwich is like. What's the outer event? What's the inner event? And if you can find how the verse is split, that'd be great. I'll put it up in a minute. But glance through from verse 12 to 21.
You've got the headings, gives it away.
Maybe, yes.
Yeah. Yes, it's the fig tree with the temple cleansing in the middle.
Yes, we're back to this idea of Mark putting the temple cleansing where he does. And again, it probably did happen like that. But we get the first bit of the fig tree story in which Jesus, we say, curses it, don't we? May no one ever eat fruit from you again. Okay, leave that behind. So that's verses 12 to 14, the fig tree. Then he cleanses the temple. And then in the next morning, there's the rest of the fig tree story, verses 20 to 21. So that's 12 to 14, 15 to 19, 20 to 21. Does it help us to understand the fig tree story because the temple has been cleansed in between? Is that what Mark is trying to help us to do, to understand? Well, you have to read it and work it out for yourself.
Interesting.
Three more. And then I've got one other important thing to say, which you might remember. So here we are in Matthew. No, it's not. It's Mark. Mark 6. 7 to 30, longer passage. Mark 6, 7 to 30. Now, I ought to help you a bit by pointing out that the last bit of the sandwich, the second slice of bread, is very, very thin. But let's start at the beginning. What happens in verse 7 onwards? What does Jesus do?
He's commissioning his disciples to go out to preach the kingdom and bring healing and deliverance.
And that goes on until which verse? When's the next bit clearly start, in other words?
12. 7 to 12?
What about 13?
13.
Yeah.
And then in verse 14, we change tack to something else. What's going to happen from verse 14 onwards? Again, you've probably got a heading to help you. No pun intended there with the word heading.
Herod.
Yes, and what's going to happen in that story?
John's going to be beheaded.
John the Baptist.
Yeah, there's more about the beheading of John the Baptist. But then, to complete the framing of it, you do get another verse, verse 30, where now the apostles report back all that they had done.
Yes.
So, verses 7 to 13, the apostles sent out and told what to do. Then in the midst of this, we read about John being beheaded, verses 14 to 29. And then we get the second bit of the frame, just sort of round it all off. They come back and report. And then I think it does go on. I think it's only one verse, really, verse 30. So again, why is it set out like this? Well, read it and see if one event helps you sort of understand another. Chapter 14, 11 verses. Now, what you get, I'll give you a bit of a hint here. It's just 11 verses, but the first two verses, I'll summarise the first two verses with one group of people and what they were trying to do.
Put Jesus to death by trickery.
And who were they?
Which well, these people? Are the chief priests and the scribes.
Chief priests and the law. Okay. Then in verse 3 onwards, we move to a different setting. So all that's going on in the background still, if you like. But meanwhile, Jesus is at Bethany and something happens.
The woman anoints his body.
Pours it over his head, that's right. So he's anointed at Bethany until which verse, do you think?
Nine.
And then what happens in the last two verses, 10 and 11?
Judas Iscariot goes to betray him to the chief priests.
The chief priests come back into play, and we're back to the plot, aren't we?
Yes.
It's the second part of the plot. So there's your sandwich there. Okay, verses 1 and 2, the chief priests setting up a plot. Meanwhile, Jesus at Bethany being anointed, verses 3 to 9, and then 10 and 11, back to the chief priests and the plot with Judas coming into it there as well. Again, there's a clear structure there that Matthew is using, and using a lot. And I think there's even more than the ones I'm giving. I'm just picking out perhaps the most interesting and the easiest ones to spot. In the same chapter 14, we get another sandwich, verse 53 to 72. Goes right to the end of the chapter. So I'll guide you here to start with. Before, the main bit is the longest bit in the middle, but the first two verses features which disciple and where?
It's Peter.
Peter, and where is he?
He's at the high priest's courtyard of Caiaphas.
In the courtyard. So the scene starts with verses 53 and 54, Peter in the courtyard. Meanwhile, in verse 55 onwards, the scene changes to where?
The Sanhedrin.
Sanhedrin, and therefore particularly Jesus on trial. And then from verse 66 onwards, where do we go back to? Peter back in the courtyard where things are all going to go pear-shaped for him, because we left him just sitting by the fire warming himself, nothing much happening. But it's almost like we've learnt about Jesus and his trial, now here's Peter's trial, and Peter didn't come out of it very well. Verses 66 and 72. So 53 to 54, Peter in the courtyard. 55 to 65, Jesus and the Sanhedrin. And 66 to 72, back Peter in the courtyard. So I'm going to leave it there because I've said a great deal. This is all part of what I mean by poetry. Poetry isn't just all sort of the boys that are on the burning deck, blah, blah, blah. It is a way of writing, constructing, helping people to remember things, because remember that they had to learn all this, it was all tradition. So the more you could structure your story, the easier it was. And also to bring out meaning by the way that things have been put together. And we might sometimes think that didn't happen then, or there's a contradiction, but actually it's there for a purpose. And Matthew does it in these little, Mark does it in these little sandwiches. Matthew does it across a whole big sort of canvas. He's painting a whole big story from beginning to end. And I'm just going to leave you with this thought. Perhaps the whole Bible is constructed in a big symmetrical pattern if we read it properly as one big story. Okay? And the way I just want to leave this with you is that at some point, why don't you just read the first two verses of Genesis? No, that's wrong. The first two chapters of Genesis, sorry, I'm getting tired. Genesis chapters 1 and 2, and the last two chapters of Revelation,
yes,
21 and 22. And not only is that an interesting section to read, sit down for 20 minutes and read Genesis 1, Genesis 2, then jump to 21 of Revelation and 22 of Revelation, because you'll find certain things come back into play again. There is a symmetry about
it. Yes, they do.
But these are the four nicest chapters in the Bible, because there's one person missing from those four chapters. I keep saying verses, four chapters. There's someone not there in those four chapters that's there the rest of the Bible.
Satan's not there.
Satan isn't there. Okay, the first two chapters before, well, he's there somewhere, but he's not in the Bible story. He doesn't appear until chapter 3. And by the time you get to Revelation chapter 21, he's been thrown into the lake of fire. So it's really nice to be able to read four chapters in which is not in the picture at all. There we are. Any final questions?
It's really Hebraic, Paul, isn't it? You know, how you know your ABBA structure, ABC, CD, yeah. CBA.
Yes.
It's really Hebraic.
It is. And it doesn't even always come across in the English. If you're studying this properly, and you could do several PhDs on all this, you would have to do it in the original language to see it at work. And I would love to do that. But what you just said is important, because it means that the Gospels are Hebraic.
Yes.
Not just the Old Testament. Jesus was Hebraic in the way he spoke, taught, the way the Gospel writers put it down, and so on. And so, yes, Hebrew poetry is different from any other kind of poetry that you may well have ever tried to study or not. Another time, we will look at other poetic aspects of things, because a huge amount of the Bible is poetry. It's worth seeing how that works. And then I'm going to start to get into the big story of how does it start? How does it end? What's the middle all about? And we'll start to look more at these things I've been talking about, like traditions and theology, which get in the way. I've still been really trying to help us, how do we read the Bible better? Because reading leads to understanding, which leads to believing. So we're trying to get into certain books of the Bible and learn how to read them. And we'll keep doing that a little bit. But sooner or later, I'm going to have to deal with the dirt in the wells of tradition, because the Bible has been churchified, among other things, and it's been commercialized. And that sometimes gets in the way of us trying to read things properly. So there's lots to do still, but that's it until January the 10th, if I've got that right. That's a Thursday. It is. So have a good Christmas, or if you don't celebrate Christmas because it's not Hebraic, then have a good time with Jesus anyway.
Absolutely.
And the year will change in our calendar, but not in the Hebrew one. But we will have a break, and I'll pick it up and do 10 sessions from January the 10th onwards. Right. Have you stopped the recording now?
Just about to. I've just got a thing from...
Unless there's an urgent comment from anybody else, is there?
Just going to say thank you very much. I'm exhausted.
I know.
got to learn to write shorthand.
You're not meant to pick everything up straight away, but hopefully you can listen to it again, or you've got... That's the point of having a break, nothing else. It gives you time to absorb some of these things and decide which you want to think more on. So,
yeah, Paul, that was great. It's such a help to be able to understand it and remember it. And I'd never seen it like that. I'd never seen it like that in Mark.
Very interesting.
No, we just don't read it in the way it was written. We read it in the way it's presented, which is chapters, verses, headings, and all this other stuff. And really, I'm going to keep coming back to this idea. Try and get a reading Bible and try and even mark it yourself in a different way. Try and do it like that. For those of you that feel, yes, it is exhausting and there's an awful lot and so on, one of the reasons for me going through all this again is not only to clarify it in my own mind, but also to get feedback as to what really works, because I do want to write this up eventually, whether it's a series of studies or whether it comes out as a book, I don't know yet, but hopefully this is worth putting down in written form so that people can look at it and take it on board again in more detail eventually.
Oh, I think so.
Definitely worth putting down in written form.